Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, where we strive to put children before adults. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Welcome to Them Before Us Radio. I am your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of Them Before Us, here with my training director, Jen Friesen. And we are going to talk to through a few of the headlines and news stories that caught our eye over the last week, especially as it relates to marriage, family, children, faith, Christianity, and the health of our nation. We do always kick things off with a little bit of Bible time. And interestingly, my 18-year-old son decided that he wanted to read through the Bible in a year, which I'm like, hey, this is great. This sounds good. We try to read the Bible before he goes to school anyway. That is a little more than we're typically able to get through, but we've had a strong start. And the other thing he decided to do is read through the Bible chronologically. And I just realized I've never done this before. So like we're in the middle of Genesis and then every now and then we're swapping in a few verses from Chronicles, right? To get in some genealogies. And he was like, hey, wait a second. It looks like Job is coming up before Exodus. And I'm like, hey, okay, yes, I guess we get that kind of ancient story in here too. And so it's interesting because I'm like, I love doing it with my kid. I love being in the Word, and it's going to be like a new thing for me. Last year, I did the 30-day shred where I did the whole Bible in 30 days. That was a little tough. This one also might be tough. But it was interesting because we were kind of talking through Genesis 1 through 3, which, you know, you've read it a million times. But reading it with your kid, he has read it only a couple times. And it was so interesting because I was like, what were Adam's curses related to? And he's like, oh, work. What was the woman's curses related to? Oh, people. And that kind of led us into this conversation about the distinctions between men and women, that women are more highly relational. Men tend to be a little more driven and focused as it relates to projects. And then kind of talking about headship, like he was naming the animals, which implies a certain kind of authority, not to say that they don't have equal value, but they have different roles. And that led us into a big conversation about how wise God was to elevate men to be the heads of the home and the heads of the church. And that while there is a critical relational element to that, that women bring in terms of sort of the social cohesion, both of those need somebody at the helm who is objective, protective, able to sniff out threats, especially. And then that we talked about moms and dads and the differences between moms and dads, and that, you know, there was one study that showed that when they were both asleep, the sound of rustling in the bushes outside would awaken the man, but not the woman. And a baby whimpering would awaken the woman and not the man. It's like even just in the design of our physiology, it points back to all of these kind of creation level distinctions between men and women. So anyway, read the Bible with your kids, discuss it with your kids, connect it to real life and modern day questions and challenges, and come back full circle to God knows what he's doing. His word is always reliable, even if it's unpopular or even if it is derided. Give it some time and the Bible will prove itself true once again. Jen, how has your kickoff to 2026 gone so far?
It's gone well. I've been doing the Bible recap. So if people have heard of Tara Lee Cobble, she does a chronological read through every year. She's on year 7 or 8 now, and does what she calls the recap and then a God shot. You know, where did you see God? What do you learn about God from this? And so, yeah, we're in Genesis, and then Job got incorporated into it. But what you were sharing made me think, too, about folks like Ali B. Stuckey have talked about toxic empathy. And Jordan Peterson, it's a quote from Jordan Peterson, talked about how everything that cries is not a baby. And it was, and this idea that women tend to be nurturing, mothering, want to take care of things, and women are getting very sucked into basically any liberal pet project that people tell them they're supposed to be protesting and proclaiming out on the street. And so you see liberal women advocating for men being in women's prisons because they identify as men. And I was wondering if you think, do men tend to think everything's a threat and women tend to think everything crying is a baby? And that way, you know, God intended for it to balance each other out, you know, a man and a woman male and female to balance each other out. We know that women are tending to see everything as a baby, but I wonder if the flip side might sometimes be true where men also need that tempering between the sexes.
Yeah. And obviously we're talking about generalities here, because in a lot of ways, my husband in some ways is more sensitive than I am in certain situations, and I'm like, buck up, kid, you're going to be fine. But then there's other situations where I'm like, come on in, do you guys need something to drink? And the person's there casing my house and they break in, you know, a week later, which happened like 12 years ago. And so like, we're talking about like generalities, but things that are generally true. So I know that in our parenting world, mine and my friends, it is very often the dad who is saying, I don't care. Like I said, get up and take the trash out, take the trash out. And then the mom might be the one that pulls him aside and says, I've been trying to get him to do his homework for the whole time. And I really just need you to come in and be really understanding right now and say that it's okay if the trash doesn't go out till tomorrow. And that's actually, those are two very useful roles, right? Somebody that says there's hard and fixed boundaries here, and somebody that says, hey, this is a really good time to bend the boundaries because there's other aims that I'm working to achieve. And it's tough when you have one or the other, but not a balance of the both. You know, if you only have the empathetic, the, okay, we can like, we can make that work this one time. And if you only have the, no, there's no exceptions. I don't care how tired you are. I don't care how hungry you are. I don't care how cold you are. Like there's a place for both of them. And that's why it's so brilliant that God made sure that both halves of the humanity were participants in making the new life, and then created systems, both biological and social and legal, to bind those two people to that new life, because they're going to need each. They're going to need both. And it's like, it's just awesome. You can look back to Genesis and see these kinds of patterns and complementarity, and the weakness, I will say, not to belabor this, but we looked at what the man and the woman were responsible for. What was their chief sin when it came to the fall? And hers was listening to voices that were wicked, but appealing. And women do tend to be a little more susceptible to things like social contagion, because they are more prone to, I kind of like him, maybe that's okay. Or, oh, you know what? It does make sense. It would make me beautiful, would make me wise. And, you know, a little social like connection thrown in, that sounds really good. I mean, even the New Testament warns about the false teachers that will sneak in. And who is it that they capture? Weak-willed women is who. And then what was the man's big sin in the fall? It was abdication. It was that he abdicated. He stepped aside. He refused to step up and do what he was called to do. And you can still see that passivity of men leading to so many of the evils that are taking place today. So anyway, nothing new under the sun. I'm sure we'll get to Ecclesiastes sometime in, I don't know, March. But that's true. Like these are timeless human truths. That's why the wisdom of Scripture and the truth of Scripture is still relevant today, because God hasn't changed and neither have we. There is some good news out of Washington State. I don't know. Maybe I get to say that once or twice a decade. But there was some good news out of Washington State, and it did have to do with a Ninth Circuit Court case that ruled that Christian organizations can be Christian, which is kind of nice. Jen, you want to give us a little rundown on this case involving the Union Gospel Mission in Yakima?
Yeah, so this was an ADF, Alliance for Defending Freedom, case where they often take conservative or Christians that are getting attacked by the local government, local, you know, city, state governments, and will defend them and take it up as high as it needs to go. Thankfully, this one, apparently the right decision was made at the Ninth Circuit Court. Now, I'm actually was searching this up a little bit because I don't fully understand how all these things work. But, you know, I don't know if you feel this way, Katie, but I feel like historically when we heard it was going to the Ninth Circuit Court, we were like, good luck. That just means the liberal, whatever progressive mindset will be affirmed. And we're hoping we could go up to the next level to get justice, basically. But what will happen is the Ninth Circuit has many, many judges. And actually, it's become much more evenly broken down between more progressive and conservative judges. I just looked, it said President Biden appointed about 16. Trump has appointed 13 in his
two administrations so far. And then what will happen is 11 judges will get randomly selected for a court case. And actually, in this case that we're going to talk about a little bit, it was a unanimous decision from the 11 judges. Mm-hmm. So I assume there's some progressive and some conservative judges on there, but they all agreed. So what happened was, it's the Yakima Union Gospel Mission. Union Gospel Mission cares for people who are homeless. They will have soup kitchens. They have job training. You know, when I was in high school, we volunteered at a local one, a local soup kitchen kind of thing. And they wanted the right to hire employees that shared the Christian beliefs of the organization. So someone who did not agree with their faith-based background wanted to be hired or didn't follow the expectations of being a Christian and was fired. And then that person sued, or they sued for the right, you know, hey, anybody who wants to work here should be able to work here. I get so irritated with this because I worked for a Christian nonprofit and people were arguing something similar, that basically we should be allowed to work here even though we don't agree. The organization should change its beliefs to let us work here. And I just don't understand. It's not like you go in to go work for the Yakima Union Gospel Mission and they have their statement of faith and they have their about on their page. And then you demand that they follow you. So anyway, state officials in Washington argued that their hiring policy violated anti-discrimination rules because they want only Christians who agree to live out their religious beliefs on marriage and sexuality. And so they sued. But yeah, the Ninth Circuit, 11 judges agreed unanimously that they have the right to hire people who agree with them, agree with their Christian mission. So that's huge.
This should be a no-brainer, not just for the Christians who would like to run a business or run a nonprofit in accordance with their Christian convictions, but for everybody. And the question is, like, who gets to decide who you are as an organization? And if you cannot decide who you are in terms of who you hire, that means the government decides who you are. And this does not make this a neutral playing field. It doesn't say, you know, well, we're going to prohibit you from discriminating in the name of religion. It says we impose a religion on you. That's really what's going on. It is, you can either have your religion or you can have the government's religion. So it's not like there's a neutral pathway here. It is just a competition of whose worldview is going to win. And don't you think it should be the worldview of the people that started the organization, are running the organization, have a mission that aligns with the convictions of the founders? Yeah, it should. I mean, otherwise, everything is statist. And the good news is, as it relates to a lot of these sort of charities and nonprofits, the religious organizations are better than the state organizations. They do a better job, right? Catholic Charities does a better job when it comes to a lot of placement for adoption and foster care. The Union Gospel Mission does a better job than the government does when it comes to actually solving homelessness and getting people off the street. So we want them to continue in their distinctly Christian identity. So this is a win, I would say, not just for religious freedom, but kind of for the functioning of society.
And two big things are that the Yakima Union Gospel Mission makes a huge point of saying their service to anyone, is not dependent on their religious beliefs. It's not that they're only going to serve Christians. It's that they're saying to be a part of working for us, you should agree with the beliefs that we have. And I don't know if I've ever seen an Islamic nonprofit or church or mosque or whatever ever brought up on charges from a blue state. When they would demand the exact same things. Are they hiring Jews who disagree with their beliefs? It's such a double standard.
Well, and there's a couple points to be made there. It's the hospitals and the foster care organizations and the homeless organizations, many of them, majority, have Christian roots. Many fewer with Islamic roots. And that tells you something about not just the religion, but the God of the religion. And ours is one who came down and worked to protect and identify with the most vulnerable. And that is a God that is worthy of following and worshiping. Stay with us. We will be right back with another story that we think matters for you. Thank you.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
We're back at Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, here with training director at Them Before Us, Jen Friesen, talking through a few of the headlines that have kind of caught our eye this week. And, you know, I remember when I was in high school in the 90s, and I was in like a global affairs class, and we had to read articles on overpopulation and how overpopulation was the big problem happening in the world, and that it created conflicts across borders, and it stressed and depleted resources, and there was going to be more wars over water, and that overpopulation was the root of all evils. And obviously, there were some governments that took that really seriously. You know, the year that I was born was the year that China instituted their one-child policy because they felt like the scarcity of resources was going to demand that they reduce their population. And it turns out that was 1,000% wrong, because now we are in a massive population decline that we're probably going to see the eradication of several ethnoses, the Koreans, at least the South Koreans, the Japanese, many smaller countries in Europe. They are so far below replacement rate when it comes to sustaining their population that they may go extinct in a couple hundred years. So it is not an overpopulation crisis. It is an underpopulation like bomb that we're looking at. And so many governments throughout the world, Japan is probably the first one to try it. A lot of different Scandinavian countries have done it too, is how do we get people to have more children? And the way that many of them have tried to solve it is give them money. Like let's just give them money. Like we can give them credits. We can give them baby bonuses. We can pay for parental leave. And so far, money has not made a difference. So, Jen, tell us a little bit about this Institute for Families study that kind of talked about how there is a financial aspect to this that might actually make a difference as it relates to people wanting to have more kids.
Yeah, so they named the report, and this was from May 2025, Pronatal Policy Works and America Can't Afford to Forgo It. So their take on the studies done around the world and looking at some different countries is that cash for kids basically does increase fertility. Well, fertility, but having children. I guess it doesn't answer the questions of people who struggle with fertility. But when governments increase direct financial support for children, fertility rises by a demographically meaningful amount. And then you and I talked about a number of ways that this can happen. Some of it basically, I think, broke down to allowing people to keep more of their money when they have children. So I guess it kind of increases, the more children you have, the less taxes you have to pay. And they kind of wiggle around with all these things. And let's see, the proposed US approach is a larger child tax credit that's usable against payroll taxes, paired with a stronger refundable credit and inflation indexing. I guess they're trying to help with, you're going to have more grocery bills, so then we'll offset it by giving you a bonus here. But then when you were looking at this, you were thinking that they kind of missed some of the data, or they're looking at the data in a different way. And you were saying that maybe this is not the right way to go about trying to get more people to have kids.
I can appreciate trying to make things financially more like lightening the financial load on people that are having children. For sure, that helps. But I don't think it changes the number of children that people are going to have from the data that I have seen. There is one thing that directly increases the birth rate. One. And it is get married sooner. The biggest problem with fertility right now is not people can't afford to have kids. It is you are getting married too late. A woman is in her prime fertility from her late teens to about 35 years old. And if a woman doesn't get married until she's 29 or 30 or 33, maybe she can have one baby. Maybe she can have two. Unlikely she'll be able to have four. And a lot of women report not having the number of children that they wish they could have. And it's not necessarily because of fertility problems or financial problems, it's because they didn't pair up soon enough. And so anybody that is talking about solving the population crisis, who is not addressing the crisis in the decline of the marriage rates, especially early marriage, We're all going to spend money on things that don't actually move the needle. And it's the same kind of trap that we're in with kind of all of the major social problems that we're facing today, which we're happy to throw money at dealing with homeless youth. We're happy to throw money at like helping people escape poverty. But the thing we won't do is tell people to change their sexual decisions, to tell people to change their relationship expectations, and to tell people you should actually not just pursue a master's degree and then a PhD and then think about getting married and having kids when you're 32. Like, to actually solve the population crisis, you should tell everybody, but especially young women, hey, prioritize marriage and kids in your 20s. But that's an area where, you know, a lot of people say, well, that's not the government's job. The government shouldn't be involved in my personal life. Well, good luck solving the population problem if government's not going to speak to the kinds of decisions that naturally lead to solving the population crisis.
Well, there's like so many thoughts I have off of this. You wrote a tweet looking at a Facebook meme kind of graphic thing that talked about the 1950s were so terrible for women because they didn't have no fault divorce. So they're trapped in these loveless marriages, and that's the only thing holding them in there is they couldn't get no fault divorce, right? And you said this basically is rewriting history to make it like women are super oppressed. The villain is the 50s and marriage, and the hero riding in on the white horse is no fault divorce. But I was thinking too, you know, women in the 30s, 40s, 50s, whatever, post-World War II, you had all this technology, the advent of technology, and being home and raising your kids really got it. You know, your laundry took however much time when you pushed the button, but still you were told your value is in being the perfect housewife and the perfect hostess, and your kids go off to government schools. And women are literally sitting around like, I was adding to the war effort, but now I'm like home and I got the pearl necklace, I guess. And what am I supposed to do? And so I do think that's a part that sort of gets ignored, is that women's work and the idea of like what it meant to be a family. And the most important part of that was like the formation of humans, and all of that just kind of got shoved off. So then the women's magazines come along that's like, no, you know where you'd actually be happy is if you go to work full time and you're an insurance adjuster. Your kids are in government school and your husband works full time and you work full time. That's true happiness. Instead of recognizing like, no, maybe there's more meaningful work you have time to do now, that the menial labor has some technology behind it. And I just think, like you said, people think the government has nothing to do with marriage. And it's like, well, the government had everything to do with wanting another 50% of the populace in the workforce. They just increase their tax base, their income taxes, all this stuff. They benefit from more bodies in the workplace and full control over your children. So it would make sense then from the conservative perspective to reframe, to re-incentivize, what does it mean to be married and have children, form your own children to be good citizens, good people, patriots, people who are adding something to the culture. But that part kind of has gotten ignored. No, the government has nothing to do with it. Well, it had everything to do with kind of messing it up.
Outside of sub-Saharan Africa, there are two countries with a above replacement rate fertility number, and they are Israel and Mongolia. You think, what on earth does Israel and Mongolia have to do with each other? And the answer is, they tell a very elevated story about the importance of motherhood. Mothers are exalted and revered, not to the status of God, but socially there's a whole narrative around the importance of this role that only a woman can play. Whereas in a lot of different circles, you know, you can actually see declining rates of marriage and parenthood among women the more degrees they get. And it's because there's a different story that they're being told, right? This is where I'm going to find value. This is where I'm living my, this is the thing that I can contribute the most to society. I mean, mothers. I mean, why would I want to take away time for the most important thing, which is getting these degrees or advancing my career? But in Mongolia and Israel, you know, Israel's a highly educated place. Those women are no dummies. But they're hearing something about the status of motherhood from all corners of society, that this is valuable and it's important, and we're going to offer you some respect and some social credit if you choose to take on, especially what is at the beginning, of a high investment, high personal cost status, you know, role. So I think a lot of this obviously has to do with how early we are getting married. But one reason why young women are not getting married early is because we're not telling the right story about motherhood. We're not telling the right story about marriage. We're not connecting it directly to this incredible, not just personal value, but social value as well.
Well, and I think this same thing could be said. I think we talked in the last week's episode about the vilification of young men, white men in particular. And the story of being a good man means caring for people who are vulnerable, being a good husband, being a father. This doesn't mean your life is over and wrecked and all your fun is going to be gone. It's the most fun, adventurous, amazing things you could do as a man or as a woman is to be a parent and bring about that next generation. So we just need a new story. You're right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we want to talk about this story too, that we saw on MSN.com. This toxic mom group breaking up with my toxic mom group. Now, this is interesting because, I have a lot to say about it, but do you want to give us kind of a rundown of what this woman was writing and what she encountered?
Yeah, this was an actress who's from the show High School Musical, Ashley Tisdale, who's now Ashley French. But she has celebrity mom group that, you know, there's a lot of drama about who's in that. But she just talked about, you know, you're looking for those moms who are similar to you in values, your kids are the same age, but all of a sudden, the same things that she experienced in high school, you're getting left out, you see people hanging out without you, you kind of get excluded when you're at the group. And she was just saying, look, you don't have to stay in a group of moms just because you're moms. That's not treating you well. And some people are saying, well, it's her personality. That's the issue here. But I just thought more broadly, you know, what's your experience being a mom before all the social media drama could even happen? And then how do you think women can navigate some of these things now?
It's interesting because you can see this on a micro level, but you can also see it on a macro level. And that is, that, you know, women don't tend to confront as directly. We tend to go around back. We tend to have a little more underhanded comments. We tend to do a little bit more, like gossip. I think gossip does tend to be a little bit more of a female specific sin. And there's been some recent clips and articles written by a woman named Helen Andrews, who says that feminine tendency to obviously value a lot of social inclusion, but then also seep it out in toxic ways. If, you know, she feels like cancel culture is a projection of the way that women specifically address conflict. So, you know, this mom, the celebrity mom, kind of got canceled in the sense that nobody came to her directly and said, we don't like you, we don't want to hang out with you. They just started to exclude her. They just started to other her, like unperson her. So I do think that these are real distinct struggles for women. Whereas guys, so funny, you know, guys, if they've got a problem with each other, sometimes they'll be like, dude, can you knock the heck off? Or, oh, there you're at it again. Are we going to do this? Oh, we're not? Fantastic. Let's move on. Or they will hit each other and fight and then be like, all right, thanks for taking care of that. Like, it's very direct, you know, physically and emotionally, which has some advantages and has some drawbacks. But I guess when I was reading this story, what I thought is, I don't have a lot of exposure to mom groups like that, because the Christian ethic and the way that we are commanded to communicate, to love, even principles like the strong are supposed to sacrifice for the weaker brother. I think in all social groups, there are very clearly people who socially are weaker, whether it's their status or their ability to communicate or, you know, what they have to offer the group. And in Christian circles, it doesn't matter, right? We're not supposed to make value judgments based on how much do I get out of this? How much do I like her? I am actually here for her. I exist not so that I can get what I want out of this relationship or be invited to the happy hour. A lot of the reason I exist is to make sure that she gets invited to happy hour. And the biblical command to directly go to somebody who has wronged you privately and show them their fault. And if you If they listen, then you've won them over. And if you don't, the answer is not to go to the Facebook moms group and then start a separate chat and tell everybody what she does. Then you find somebody else to go with you to establish the matter. I mean, like, there's just healthy ways to communicate and forbidden ways when it comes to talking about the things that you cannot do in the Christian circle that, just in my opinion, has made it a pretty healthy environment when it comes to friend groups. So anyway, I feel for her. I feel for this struggle because I know other women have faced it too. I'm just so grateful that God has given us patterns of communication, requirements of how to connect with one another. That largely means that I think a lot of Christian women, at least in my world, don't have to deal with some of these toxic environments where they are excluded or they are shunned. And let me just say, that's actually incredibly painful. Like, we need human connection like we need food. Like, cruel and unusual punishment, you know, in the prison system, for example, is solitary confinement. Like, even if you are in a prison, at least you've got some fellowship, you know, at the meals or, you know, in the yards or when you're exercising or whatever. But to be socially isolated, it is detrimental to who we are as humans. And that's why these kinds of examples of being excluded in real life or even online is so painful. So it's an opportunity for all of us to reject the way the world operates when it comes to connecting, you know, when it comes to dealing with confrontation. And for women especially, I think that calls us to let the Bible direct our steps more than our own insecurity or what might naturally come to us when it comes to conflict resolution. We're supposed to be different, do different. And maybe the celebrity mom is going to find her group of people that treats her differently, and maybe they will be believers. We'll be right back with your questions and answers.
If you'd like to comment on the show, email comments@thembeforeus.com. Once again, here's Katie Faust.
Hey everyone, welcome to Here for the Comments, where we're going to take on comments that we see across all of our social media, or we're going to take questions that we get in DMs, or even things that we've scoured from all the different places of the corners of the internet, let's say. And I'm Jen Friesen. I also host the TBU podcast, and we're joined by Sam Deloach, who's at Pro Life Rights on Substack and on social media, who's our communications manager, who just joined us, I think, December or November. So welcome.
Yeah, super recent.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm so excited about it.
Yeah, it's been super fun. And we love laughing about the comments in our staff chat or engaging with the comments, thinking about how we would answer different things. And that's part of what we want Here for the Comments to be about, is helping equip those who are listening or watching these videos. When you're faced with these different comments or situations, how should you reply? How should we think about it in a TBU children's rights perspective? So first question I have for you, this is from a direct message that Katie got. It is a man reaching out who said he has an 8-year-old student with no legal guardian and an 89-year-old grandpa holding her from allowing anyone younger to care for her. The girl's mother died 1.5 years ago and the father was never present in her life. But this is not a sweet, loving grandpa situation. He's narcissistic and emotionally abusive. I've called CPS twice. My question for you is, what would you say about an almost 90-year-old man caring for an 8-year-old little girl? I'm curious what your stance would be on getting this child out of the situation. What do you think, Sam?
Yeah, that's really hard. So I would say, without any more context, like, I don't have like a blanket thing about 90-year-olds. So there are situations where I feel like the grandparents would actually be great to step in if a parent dies, because you want to try to stick with family. But in this specific situation, it sounds like it's like an abusive situation. It sounds like he's not taking care of the child, which is the issue. So honestly, unfortunately, I think the best way is to report it. And like, again, if you see something, say something, and try to help, because that's a very young age, 8, you know, that's not like somebody who's 16 and almost on their own anyways. An 8-year-old does need a lot of care. And so if he's not able to do it, then I would definitely see if there's any other family members, aunts, uncles, any community members, any church members, anybody who they might already know who could step up and be there for them first. and get them out of that situation for sure. But I wouldn't make that like a blanket statement against all grandparents or really old people, because I think there are situations where that could be ideal. If a parent dies and then you have like the mother of that parent taking care of the child or something like that, if they're able to. And so I think that's what it really boils down to, if they're willing and able. So,
right. Yeah. And the guiding principles for Them Before Us are, of course, biological mom and dad married in the home are ideal for the child, except if there's abuse. So always, right. And we get this a lot, folks want to compare, well, what if you have just the most perfect same-sex couple that's ever walked the face of the earth compared to their abusive biological parents, which one's better? And it's easy to say, and we're always going to say, it's always better for a child not to be abused. But let's compare apples to apples. Perfect bio mom and dad married, perfect same-sex couple, who's better? It's always going to be better to be with your bio mom and dad that are married, all things being equal, right? So let's not compare extreme circumstances to something that's perfect. And so in this case, well, and then, yeah, when we consider foster care and adoption, I think it is good, like you said, to prioritize kinship bonds. You still should be connected to the folks who have genetic identity connection with you. They knew your parents. I could see, you know, let's say there's no extended family, but you have a close family friend, married couple that could raise the child in a very similar values and they know the parent. Okay, then that would probably be that second level ideal than being raised across the country with strangers. So there's all these sort of competing scenarios that could happen, but we're always for not being abused and we're always for bio mom and dad whenever possible. And then we would probably say mom and dad whenever possible. And yeah, I agree with you. You know, should there be an age cutoff where you're not allowed to care for children anymore? I think it goes back to, is there neglect? Is the person able to drive? Is the person able to take them to school? And you probably have to make some arguments too. Like consider, let's say it was a grandpa, but it was a little boy. Can he wrestle with him? Can he take him to the activities? It just seems like it's kind of the same as a single parent. You have to acknowledge for yourself where are the gaps in what you can offer a child. And I think it's good to be connected to your kin. But should there be some other things going on where this grandpa is trying to make more available for the girl than just himself? That's where I think that's like a little bit of a red flag.
I agree. You know, again, there's going to be not every parent can offer everything, you know, you're not going to be perfect. So in general, like you said, if family can be the one caring for the child, that's great. But if he can't, if he's not, if he's being abusive or if he's too old to actually care for this 8-year-old, then yeah, unfortunately you're going to have to find a new situation for them.
Well, and shouldn't the question that adults are always asking be not, what do I want? What is best for the child? Should always be a question. And unfortunately, it feels like even the court system is not necessarily answering or asking that question anymore. When they're prioritizing kinship, but you're putting them back into a family that's enabled an abuser or a drug addict, then is that the best thing for the family? So maybe connection, but maybe not living with them full time.
Yeah. And it's so hard because a lot of these processes take way too long. You know, like he's 8 now. And if they start getting DCF involved and they do have to find a new home, it's like by the time they find a new home, it's like, will grandpa even be there anymore if he's already in his 90s, you know? So, it's a system that needs reform for sure.
One of the things Katie has asked us to put out is another call for people who have donor conceived stories. So if you came to me because your, I guess, parent, your mom or dad chose an egg donor or a sperm donor and you were conceived with donor conception, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at thembeforeus.com. But we put out a graphic calling for these stories on our social media. And I just wanted to read you some of the comments that we got so we could talk a little bit about the response, some of the responses that we got.
Okay. So one person said, these yet, so I'm excited.
Yeah, right. One person said, just like you were talking about, oh, she tagged someone. So they were having a separate conversation, but she tagged this person and said, just like you were talking about, politically and religiously motivated groups are swooping in to exploit the stories and experiences of donor-conceived people. not because they care about donor-conceived people, but just to further a specific narrative and agenda. And let me just say, the ask, the graphic said, share your donor-conceived story. That was it. And the caption probably had a little, actually, I'll look it up as you're sharing your initial thoughts. And let me see if the caption said anything controversial.
You know, the frustrating thing about this is that, like, I mean, anybody who's posting on social media, any organization, any, you know, person who's religious or not religious, like, we all are seeking things from that viewpoint. You know, like, you have a, this person has a non-religious viewpoint that they see things through, like, their lens in life. And we have a religious viewpoint with our lens in life. And so it's like, that's just how it works. That's how the world works. It's like, everybody has a different way that they see things. And it's not like this scheme that we're like out to get you. Like, we genuinely believe that there is a right way to care for children and there is a wrong way to care for children. And we're saying that if there are situations where children have been like hurt, then we want to hear those stories because our aim is to end that situation and end the hurt. And honestly, it doesn't even take a religious person to feel that or to be motivated to do that. A lot of our followers aren't religious. A lot of our followers, you know, don't believe in God, but they still can see the conflict of child rights when it comes to donor conception. And so it's very, you know, again, it's lazy. I would say it's lazy because, like, if you actually had an argument against what we're doing, we would love to hear it. We would talk about it. We would address it. We would love to, like, debate. But instead of actually coming to us with a legit argument, you just write us off and say, well, they're religious. So even though we didn't use a religious argument. So right. I'd say it's a little lazy.
Yeah. Yeah. This is the caption we had. If you were donor conceived, we want to hear from you. Your story matters. By sharing your experience, you help expose the real human cost of donor conception and educate others about a child's inherent right to know and be raised by the mother and father they came from. Like you're saying, we have an agenda. We have a purpose, of course.
Yep.
What's interesting, though, and this is my pushback to them, is they don't have a problem with the other side's agenda a lot of the time. A lot of the time when someone who's donor conceived and it's from an LGBTQ like family situation, you know, hey, we went and got this child this way, and they are very pro LGBT, they're not critiquing it from that perspective. They're okay with kids saying, I'm from a sperm donor. I'm totally fine with it. I don't care. Never missed my dad. I love my two moms. No problem. Right. They have no problem with that story being amplified. They have no problem with the human rights campaign putting that story to promote their particular agenda. And our thing is, every story pretty much has been on that side.
Yep.
We're just one of the few people starting to say, here's the stories from the other perspective. And then this is kind of the commentary we get because we want to elevate or platform at all the other side of the coin, you know?
Right. Right. Yeah. No, they just, again, it's like, if you're not on their side, even if you're a victim, all they want to do is shut you up. And so it's, that's why we're here. I mean, that's literally our purpose, is we try to, like, help these people who don't have a voice in all the different categories that we do our work in. And this is a big category for that, because conception donor children, they don't have a voice because people are shutting them up from every angle. And so they need somebody who's going to be able to elevate their stories and get them out there and be heard. So that way we can move forward and try to fix the issue that caused all the trauma to them. So right. Yeah, that's why we do what we do.
Yeah, this is another comment that said, beware that your donor conceived story will be spun into religious propaganda here. If that's not your jam, maybe take pause, signed a donor conceived person. And I was trying to think if we'd interacted with this woman before. I looked at her account a little bit. But again, it's kind of obviously she doesn't agree with our perspective. So then it's religious propaganda, which again, when we do not take people's donor conceived stories and say, that's what God said, therefore you shalt not use a sperm donor. We just are not making an argument from that at all.
Yeah.
And unless she's looking at our small group curriculum, which is a great resource, if you are Christians, people of faith that want these resources for your churches, shameless plug, that takes our Them Before Us nonpartisan, not religious arguments, and then we intersect it with the Christian ethic. So that's great. Mm-hmm. But that's not our
typical post and our typical argumentation is God said it in the Bible. And actually, God didn't say don't do sperm donation in the Bible. You know, if people who want to say the words sperm donation didn't show up, so it's okay. It's like, well, that's, we're not using that argument. We're using a pretty basic biological argument. Did you see Katie's post? It was a really cute sibling video. And do you remember what she said about what it made her think?
Yes. Yeah. The pod children, the sibling pods. That one honestly hurts my heart so much because I'm one of seven kids. And so I have six siblings, same mom and dad, and all of them are so important to me. We are a very close family. We all live very close together, see each other constantly. I live across the street from one of my sisters. And I could not imagine my life without any one of them, like that you can't trade them out for anything. And it's insane to think that there are so many kids growing up who actually have siblings, you know, half siblings, but still siblings, and they'll never get to have a relationship with them in the way that God designed us to have relationships with our siblings, literally just because adults had this desire to build a family the way they wanted to, even though that's not what was best for the kids involved. And so it really is stolen something from them that I feel like is irreplaceable. You know, there's nothing that could substitute those relationships for me in my life. It's really tragic.
Yeah, the biggest sibling pod I've ever heard of, I think this was on the BBC, was 600 half siblings. So a kid has 599 half siblings. You know, if you have a pretty prolific sperm donor.
Yeah. Wasn't there, there was also a documentary, I thought, like maybe on Netflix or something, with the guy who had 1,000 kids, and he was trying to go and visit every kid. And he was saying that it was very emotional for him because he said for some, you know, he had this instant connection with so many of them just like right away. And it's like, you don't realize how far genetics go. They're not everything, obviously, you know, they don't mean the world, but they do mean something, you know, something very important. And, you know, even cousins that I have that I barely see, the minute that we're back together and we've reunited, it's like there's always like this comfort level that like I just have with them versus like a stranger that I've never met before and I'm not related to, because we're related. And that's what, it's a big deal. So,
yeah. Well, hey, everyone, thanks for joining us for Here for the Comments. If you have a comment you'd like to submit to us, screenshot it, send it over, tag us in comments that you see. We're building the ambassador program of social media warriors. So if you want to join us with that, you can DM us or email us at thembeforeus.com. We would love to have you. And yeah, like and subscribe, share this with a friend, tell us what you think down below. We appreciate you guys joining us.
Thank you so much.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.